Welcome. Welcome to UCT. Welcome to our course. And welcome to a warm Cape Town. As you sweat, you might give a thought to the fact that UCT is saving a lot of carbon by keeping you warm and saving our planet. I want to begin by introducing myself. My name is Clifford Shearing, and I work at the Center of Criminology, which is in this law faculty. And for my sins there, I am the director of the center, the chair of criminology, and the South African research chair of security and justice. There we go. And the South African research chair of security and justice. And I hail from Durban, where I went to the University of Natal. The good news is that I went there after I failed as a farmer. I went and tried to be a cowboy after school in the Drakensberg, but got fired and was thrown out of the district entirely and told never to come back. So what else was there to do but to go to the university? And once I completed my undergraduate there, I had a most splendid undergraduate education in sociology. I think, despite what all the moans, the best one I could have possibly had in the world. And then I went on walkabout, as the Australians would say. And I first walked to New York, and then I walked to Toronto, and spent some 35 years in Toronto, where I became the director of the Institute of Technology at the University of Toronto. And then I walked, or figuratively walked, off to Australia to join the Australian National University and to help establish a new institute there on regulation called RegNet. And I stayed there for 5 years, and then at the end of 2006, I very happily returned to South Africa and very happily returned to Cape Town. Now, I will try not to emulate either Mark or Jeremy, and to keep my sights firmly on Nikki in keeping on time. I've had a feeling, I know you've all had, of what an enormous treat it has been to be able to sit back and listen to Mark, and then to Nikki, and then to Jeremy. And I felt just like Mark's little dog, as I enjoyed every minute of it. This treat, however, has presented me with a bit of a problem. As we all now know a great deal, and a great deal more, about what the great social thinkers has said about the human question. And so I began to wonder what on earth I can say. Can I offer anything as I sat here like Mark's dog listening? And this came to a crisis point yesterday when I heard Jeremy speak. So I promptly left here, walked up to my very pleasant office on the sixth floor of this building, took the notes that were on the desk and promptly put them in the recycling bin. And I began to think about what I might do. Planning something else that would answer the question, who is the criminal, in a way that would help us understand our human question. So one of the things I'm going to do, you can't hear at the back. Can anyone turn this speaker up? Is that possible?
Speak closer to the mic. But
then I can't.
Then I can't read my notes.
In between.
All right. If I get hoarse and I need a doctor, those of you at the back will have to find one for me.
Just push it down a bit. It's like you look down.
I wish I had Jeremy's booming voice. He didn't need a microphone. So I thought I'd take up a number of the issues, and it'll mean I will go over some ground of that Jeremy covered with Hobbes, but I want to emphasize some things he didn't. I also want to take up Jeremy's suggestion that he put that we should look at why sociologists have looked at nurture rather than nature. And I'll try and also do that. So to begin, I want to begin with some remarks which review what I think are some of the more important points that have stood out for me in our 3 days. One of the themes that have cut across all of the speakers is that all of them have referred to one of the defining features of the human, is that the human is a storyteller. Another way of saying this is that we like to build models, we like to build theories, we like to understand the world around us. And actually, through understanding it, we create it. We create the world we inhabit. And these models are things we use that help us act in the world. So an important feature of the human condition is that as long as we're alive, and we share this with any other entities, is we have to act. Not only do we have to act, we have to keep on acting. We can't stop. We have a problem that the English sociologist Anthony Giddens called the problem of going on. And it's this pressing problem. What am I going to do next? What am I going to do next? How am I going to do it? And as we have heard from Marx, we're lucky we don't have to figure this out all the time. We have instincts that help us decide how to go on. We have instincts, just like other mammals, that say, flee! Fight, run, be outraged, so on and so forth. And they help us with this problem of going on, including despair and grief. But as Marx has argued, this is not all there is to human action. As we humans also tell stories, and these stories paint pictures of the nature of the worlds in which we live. And these pictures about ourselves and others often lead us, as Marx has told us, to constrain our instincts. And in doing so, what we do is we open up pathways. We open up new pathways to action that we sometimes actually follow, and we'll ask ourselves why, but sometimes we don't. Now, this sort of strategic action, as Jeremy told us, isn't only available to humans. Chimpanzees are also strategic, and there may be other primates as well. Of course, to find evidence of our love of storytelling, you only have to go to any place where humans are relaxing. Any pub will do, any braai will do, any dinner party will do. And as we know, once we humans get into full flight with our stories, it's difficult for anyone else to get a word in edgewise. Now, what Nikki and Jeremy in particular have done so well over the past few days is to tell us something about the big stories we have told, the big influential stories we have told about ourselves and others, at different places and at different times. For example, the stories then created by Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau. And as Nicky told us, people like Smith and Marx. And although these are old stories, they are still with us. And we still use them. They're still important to us, even though, as we know, they don't take into account the work that Marx has been doing and other neurosciences. But they're still with us. They still shape the way we act. These influential stories that philosophers tell are also common sense stories. They're your stories and my stories. And the contemporary philosopher John Gray offers an explanation of this when he writes, somewhat irrelevantly, that philosophy is an attempt to find good reasons for conventional stories, which I think is very true. Something else that Nicky and Jeremy have shown us in their talk is that when one dissects the stories we create, they often, indeed typically, prove to have a pretty simple architecture. Perhaps one of our inbuilt features is we can't tell very complicated stories. They tend to have a pretty simple architecture. Another way of saying this is that our most influential stories tend to be based on fundamental ideas or images, what the wonderful sociologist, American sociologist Herbert Blumer called root images. Something else useful that we have learned over the past 3 days is that the models that shape our action are often implicit, rather than explicit, as they are embedded in our habits and in the organizations within which and through which we so often act. They are embedded, to use a nice phrase that is sometimes used to define culture, in the way we do things around here, including the way we do things about crime and security. This means that the fact that humans can't always explicitly tell you what their stories are does not mean that they are not shaping them and shaping their action. And the anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss expressed this rather nicely, I thought, when he commented that he did not aim to show how men think in myths, but rather how myths think in men, albeit unbeknownst to them. Very nice idea. This brings me, finally, to what I'd like to do this morning. What I propose to do is to explore with you some of the models that we humans have built that have shaped, and most importantly, continue to shape, the way you respond to those troublesome people in our lives we call criminals. And those troublesome events in our lives we call crime. A quick caveat before I get going. In exploring these models, I will not be asking whether these stories are true. I'm not going to do what Marcus do. What is the true story about instinct? What is the true story about human nature? My interest in rather understanding these stories and understanding how these myths or theories or science, if you like to think of, work through us and act through us in the way Lévi-Strauss suggested. Help us in the business of going on. In the business of going on with respect to criminals, crime, order, disorder. Further, just as Marx cautions, and I say it again, I'm not arguing, just as he cautioned that instincts didn't tell the whole story, I'm not arguing that stories tell the whole story either. They parted our story, or my story. And I want to caution too against me saying that instincts are unimportant, or that the biological human is unimportant. Although some of the people, as you'll see, that I'll speak about towards the end, come pretty close to saying that, and I'll try and explain why they do. It seems quite extraordinary, but they do, and we act on that. So, we as humans, as you can imagine, have not been laggards when it comes to building models about crime and criminals. And clearly this morning I can only deal with one or two of these. In selecting these models, I've selected some that have, and I think continue to have, a huge impact on how we govern ourselves and our security. What do you do here to make your life secure? That is, they shape our attempts to create spaces which are safe, in which we hope to be able to live, to work, and to play. In what follows, I'm going to focus my attention initially and principally on a model of crime and criminals that has been extraordinarily influential in shaping how we as a society tend to respond to crime and criminals. A model that you'll see has very strong resonances to what Hobbes had to say, which will bring me back to Hobbes in a moment. This is a model that is often in our heads, so to speak, but it's a model that's embedded in our habits. Like the habit, for example, of calling the police. Someone hits you, I'm going to call the police. Why? What on earth makes you think that that's a good idea? What on earth makes you think that that is a good idea? We need to find that out. Or spending money on the police, which I'm going to talk about in a moment. That's another habit we have. What should we do about crime? Let's get more police. Do you know how much it costs to put one police officer on duty, even though we don't pay them much, 24 hours a day in your neighborhood? 1 million rand. Every time you say, give me a policeman, you say, here's 1 million rand. And I'm prepared to take out of our pockets and give to you. Have you thought about how else you might spend that 1 million rand? No, because we have this theory and we have this habit. I'm going to call this model control theory. And another term I'm going to use is often used to describe as bond theory. And you will soon see, I hope, why I think these are appropriate terms. To give you a better idea about the consequences of this kind of model, let me pause for a moment and share with you some numbers about how much you and I spend on the institutional arrangements which are deeply informed by control theory, namely on our institutions of criminal justice. Worth thinking about. At the national level in South Africa, which is not the only level, we spent well over 100 million rand in the financial year 2010-2011 on the criminal justice system, keeping us secure. And that, as I said, is just what the national government spends. Speak up again. No, it's the police, corrections, and courts. 100 billion. Not 100 million. 100 billion would be nice, but 100 billion. Let's get that B right. That's about a quarter of what our national government spends on services for you. All of the other ones included. Hospitals, education, you name it. Of that 100 billion, about half is spent on an institution called the South African Police Service. And as if this were not enough, you like to add to this, especially the kind of people in this room. Because we spend about another 40 billion rand in this country on private security. And this buys us, among other things, and that's only the tip of the iceberg of private security, because it only counts in these estimates, hardware and people. There's much more than that. We have about 200,000 police, and we have about 400,000 private security people wandering around your neighborhoods, waving at you from their little boxes or on their bikes. These are not small numbers. When it comes to our pocketbooks, what these numbers show is that when it comes to control theory, we're willing to put our money where our mouths are, or rather where our theories are. Now, once I'm through with talking about control theories, if there's time, it doesn't actually look as if there'll be a lot, but we'll do our best, I will talk about the nurture and the nature issue. And if there's still time, I will take you on a little personal journey I took and what I discovered on that journey and how it shaped many of the things I've done. And if there's still time, and any of you are willing to stay, I'd like to do a little bit of market research with you, because I'm just about to publish a popular book and I need to choose a cover. All right. Okay. As my Canadian friends would say, enough already. Let's take out our analytic microscopes and have a look at control theories. And as I said, let me apologize in advance for taking you over areas you've been through. At the heart of control theory, as we've already heard from Jeremy, is an image, is a model that imagines the human, to use John Gray's wonderful words, as an exceptionally rapacious primate. Very nice. So at the core of control theory is the notion of the human as a wild creature. That, if left to their own devices, will end up in constant and endless conflict with other rapacious primates, namely other humans. I put up the cover of John Gray's book because I think it has quite a nice image of what a rapacious primate looks like. I'm also going to put up an image that comes from Kirsten Weisch. I do so not because I think it's of any particular analytic value over Gray's, but I think it's a beautiful image by Dylan Lewis, which is at this new exhibition, permanent exhibition, called, nicely, Untamed. The idea of a human as a wild creature expresses a way of thinking that has strong resonances with Thomas Hobbes, who, in 1651, published what proved to be an enormously influential thesis, Leviathan. any of us had a book that compared 1/1,000,000th to Leviathan and Impact, we'd be doing well. I don't know how many languages it's been put into. And what Hobbes did, he viewed the human as rapacious and particularly greedy, a being driven by passions. They certainly didn't deny instincts. Again, to summarize Jeremy, he said humans in a state of nature, and that's all they had was their instincts, were in a constant state of war, in which every other person was at war with every other. He called this, in a nice phrase, the war of all against all. For Hobbes, this is an interesting state, and it's important for us. I think he makes an important point in understanding what we mean by security. He says he doesn't mean it's a state when everybody is constantly fighting. He means it's a state when you expect to be fighting at any time. So you can be not fighting, but that for Hobbes isn't peace. That's war, because the prospect of conflict exists at all times. And I put up a quote in a moment from Hobbes that you can read at your leisure. This, as we heard, feature of a human has very nasty consequences, Hobbes tells us. And it creates a problem for Hobbes. A problem that the 20th century sociologist Talcott Parsons calls the Hobbesian problem of order. The problem is, if humans are indeed so rapacious, and if they're about to end up in conflict all the time, how come you're sitting here without fighting with each other? How is that possible? How come there are lots of spaces where people do seem to be living in peace without the threat of war? Now, interestingly, and it's very important often in arguments to see what the first step in the argument is. It usually structures the whole argument. What Hobbes does not question is his premise in trying to explain why we don't have war all the time, in his sense. He accepts his premise. I mean, Mark, we know, would question this premise, and other primatologists and others would question it, but Hobbes accepts it. People are rapacious primates, always potentially fighting. He doesn't argue that there's any flaw there. Instead, he goes on to say, given this, which we know is correct, and he only just made it up, there must be something else at play. There must be something else that actually shapes human action, that accounts for this difference between our prediction from the theory and what actually happens. Not too many rapacious people in here, hopefully. And his answer is a very simple one, a very simple word, often neglected. It's simply rules. Rules are the answer. Rules do it. In more contemporary terms, we might say regulation. Regulation does it. What humans do is create rules. And we heard from Jeremy some of the ways in which they do that. And these rules, through mechanisms we haven't specified yet, bind or control humans. Now, this for Hobbes is where reason comes in, prefrontal cortex. Because it's reason that tells us we should go about doing this. Now I want to move on from Hobbes and where Jeremy, I want to move on a bit from where Jeremy left us. To assist me, I'm going to put up that wonderful image that Jeremy briefly showed you by the wonderful French artist and printmaker, Aubry Ambos, who with Hobbes's assistance created the frontispiece for Leviathan. And it's an extraordinary and remarkable image, because in a single image it captures so much about the root images that inspire this whole book. You can read the whole book almost from that image. At the center of the image, as you will have noticed, is a benign giant who rules over a territory. As the image makes clear, one of the things that makes this giant benign is he's not separate from the people. This ruler does not, as Jeremy told us, rule by divine right. Rather, his authority and legitimacy come from the fact that he is, in Boss's image, literally made up of people. He's an assemblage of men, which is one of the terms that that Hobbes uses. Now also what is very nice to have it is how the giant rules. In his left hand, he holds a crozier, as an image of authority, of pastoral care, of legitimacy. And I'll speak a little bit more about what control theorists have done with that. In his right hand, he carries a weapon, his access to coercion. And this access to force, which the German sociologist Max Weber told us is essential for good rulers, enables the giant to overcome any resistance he might come across in his rule. And this conception that we've just been through, all humans, all of us, are potentially criminal, because we're all down there deep somewhere. We're all wild creatures. And the only thing that separates us from our wildness is a prison of rules. We're imprisoned, and I'll talk about how in a moment, within rules. These silly little things called rules have become our prison. Now, a major preoccupation of control theorists over many years has been attempting to understand, first, the nature of the mechanisms required to allow rules to bind humans. How is this going to be done? How are we going to build this prison? And also, of course, what is to be done when the rules fail? And when the rapacious primate is released from prison? The principal answer to the first of these questions is captured by the simple notion of socialization or internalization. The underlying idea here is that humans become civilized when rules completely dominate and indeed obliterate the passions. That is, when the software of rules completely suppresses the hardware of the biological human. This idea is very nicely captured in the Jesuit adage about socialization. It says, socialization must take place during the first 7 years of a child's life. If rules are to be effective in binding the wild creature. Now, Talcott Parsons, who I mentioned earlier, who I must also add, when I was an undergraduate, was definitely the bane of my entire existence. Used this wonderful term, need disposition, to describe what happens when socialization or internalization works well. What happens, he says, is that new needs are formed. The software creates new needs which replace the old needs, the old passions, as a source of motivation, of human motivation. What happens then is you don't feel as if you're in prison. You want to do everything that the rules are imprisoning you, want you to do. You're a willing actor here. Now that is good social order for Parsons and for control theorists. When you don't even feel the urge to be rapacious anymore. When you no longer see yourself as a biological human, because you have been so transformed. So socialization transforms you from a wild human into a civilized human. Listening to classical music, having a wonderful time, doing this, that, and the other thing. Lovely restaurants. Once this happens, as the Jesuits argue, there'll be no need for a sword. This is an ideal in policing, policing by consent. No need for a sword. Police can be kept in their barracks, because there'll be no need for them anymore. Well, police by consent. Okay. Now, those control theorists, of course, as you'd expect, to focus their attention on this, tend to have policy suggestions like strengthen families. Sometimes these are not really PC at all, like strengthen the nuclear family with one husband and one wife, bringing up two or three children. American sociologist Hershey suggests this. But also, strengthen religious faiths. Enhance what happens in kindergartens. These are the sort of policy implications of this. Now, the second preoccupation of control theorists is what to do when socialization fails. How do we apply the sword? Now attention shifts from internal constraint. You feel compelled to do this, so we don't have to tell you to do it. Now, when your children just naturally are well behaved at the table, naturally are polite, naturally put their serviette on their lap at all times. You know those children? What happens when they are not like that? As most of my grandchildren are. Now we have to persuade them. And the principal way control theorists persuade us is supplying pain to our bodies. Apply pain, you'll create new desires to get away from the pain. Another kind of an instinct. The question is, what pain, how is it to be applied, how expensive is it, and so on. And what kind of pain are we ethically comfortable with? Jeremy told us over the years, as Elias and others have told us, we become less and less comfortable with thumb screws. Very effective ways of creating pain. that we are less comfortable with. And then the other option, only really two options, was incarceration. Just keep them out of harm's way. Here we have an option which is very effective too. It's called capital punishment. But we become less happy with it too. So we prefer prison, which is quite expensive and usually doesn't do what we hope it will do. So those are the options. Now, a picture that nicely summarizes this is the cover of the book Thin Blue by that truly wonderful South African criminologist, Johnny Steinberg. He's an author in many other areas as well. And the title is interesting. The notion of the police as a thin blue line enforcing rules that keeps the wild creature at bay. And the image on the book is interesting. A masked police officer, a kind of lone ranger, a pistol, an automatic rifle, and of course, a symbol that has come to symbolize South African insecurity, barbed wire or razor wire. These are the instruments we use, among others, to tame the wild creature that socialization hasn't tamed. Now there's a lot more I could say about control theory, but if I do so, I'm not going to say anything about anything else. Now, I'm not going to say much more either. I've got 10 minutes, I figure. We'll talk about a broad collection of ideas, another set of stories about the nature of the human that have established a fair degree of both analytic and policy traction within criminology. Both share the feature of seeking to focus explanation within criminology on the social elements rather than the biological elements. That is, both these sets of ideas, both these stories, to go back, emphasize the notion of nurture over nature. While these theories, and this has a lot to say, as we'll see, about the way we think about crime and criminology, it turns what we've been talking about a bit on its head. What these theories argue, that the considerable variation we find in societies in crime and criminality can't be explained by nature. And that we need to focus more on nurture. And Jeremy argued, and I don't want to go into this, there are various political and ideological reasons that we can think about for why this happens, including people like Emile Durkheim, the French sociologist, who felt that if sociology was to be an independent scientific discipline, it had to have a domain of its own, and it had to explain things in those domains on their own terms. Social facts needed social explanations. But we certainly don't have time for that. What is important to consider is this shift from nature to nurture and the way new stories came to be told about the human, or different stories with different root images to the root images of control theories. The first set of these ideas I want to call cultural theories. And I want to include within that a subset called labeling theories. This set of theories focuses on the fact that, in fact, although you may not imagine this from control theory, people don't agree on the rules. Now, what happens to control theory? People don't agree on the rules, don't all have the same rules. What happens if you're socialized into different rules? And they look around and they say, well, we've got pretty heterogeneous societies now. We've got very plural societies. Plural, particularly in the rules and the values. So what these theorists begin to think and argue is, you know, perhaps rules, rather than being a source of order, are a source of disorder. Perhaps it's these rules that we put our money on are actually a source of disorder. They're the source of the problem. The problem is in the rules. And some of these conflicts over rules can be pretty serious and pretty deadly. I spent a few years in Northern Ireland as a member of the Patent Commission redoing policing there. There's some conflicts over rules and values there that were pretty deadly. And we only have to look at Africa to see that right now, here and elsewhere. And where this conflict isn't happening, they argue, in the same way as Hobbes's notion of war, they said often these conflicts over rules are just below the surface. They could kind of break out at any time. Now, what this sort of thinking introduced into criminology was the importance of taking power into account. And more specifically, the ability of one group to enforce its rules over your rules. Now, this is something that hadn't been taken into account in the same way in control theory. This sort of thinking that I'm just suggesting has been corrosive to some of the ideas in control theory. Especially when it comes to defining what order is and what good order is and who the criminal is and what crime is. It seemed quite obvious before, not so obvious now. Because your order may well be my disorder. Your good behavior may well be my crime. So all of a sudden, this world that seemed to have these fairly solid objects in it begins to fall apart in our hands. Now, the root images of criminality take on a political hue. Crime becomes a political category. And more importantly, crime, or calling something a crime, becomes a political weapon. We don't need to be told that as South Africans with our history. What is and what is not crime reflects who has managed to get hold of the crime-defining machine. And what is and is not punished as crime depends on who happens to get hold of the crime-punishing machine. Now, there's a lot of conflict over who will control these machines. That's what democracy is called about, if we have it. So, who gets hold of these machines gets to decide what crime is and who the criminal is. In a sense, crudely, who goes to jail and who doesn't? For what? The criminal, interestingly now, in some versions of this, gets transferred, transformed from being an offender, a nasty, rapacious primate without constraint and control who deserves no sympathy at all, into something of a victim. The poor people who are now being punished for having their beliefs. A Now, this is quite a turn of events from where we were. A victim who's been targeted simply because they believe something else and they have less power than you to make rules, to make them stick, and to apply the pain to get you to do what they want, and to control the kindergartens and the textbooks. What about all of that? Aha! Plot thickens. One of the sub-themes, I said, it comes to be called labeling theory. Labeling theory took up this idea that the meaning of objects in the world, particularly whether they are good, you're a good or a bad citizen or person, and so on, was not a feature of the object. Just think about this for a minute. This is, has huge implications. It means your crime rates don't mean anything. Because who knows what you decide to call crime or not. And I'll get on to that in a moment, especially as the police create your crime rates. Anyway, so it's not an intrinsic feature of the object, but is dependent on who is looking at that object. It was, in other words, all a matter of perspective. For the labeling theory, crime could not and should not be regarded as a property of the act. As some of you could just show me an act, I'll tell you if it's a crime. It couldn't, it cannot be understood until a label is applied for it. It's like going into a furniture store. You don't know whether something is sold or not until there's a label on it. You can't buy that. You can buy this. So the meaning of that object in the label, in the store, depends on the label. It's not intrinsic in the object, that particular meaning. What they're arguing too is there's no intrinsic connection between an act and a label. Now it's interesting to talk to Mark about this, but you say, well, there's some values that are built into our biological structures. And the connection is purely political, according to these theories. Purely arbitrary, actually. Now, I want to read to you a passage from Howard Becker, who's a wonderful American sociologist whose name is very closely associated with labeling theory. Social groups, Howard Becker writes, create deviants by making the rules whose infraction constitutes deviants. And by applying those rules to particular people and labeling them as outsiders. From this point of view, deviance is not a quality of the act the person commits, but rather the consequence of the application by others of rules and sanctions to the offender. The deviance is one to whom the label has been successfully applied. Deviant behavior is behavior that people so label. The idea that there's no intrinsic criminal that is so essential to control theory that did not go down well, as you can imagine, in many, many circles. To illustrate, a colleague of mine in the days in which I was in Toronto, he isn't with us any longer, Richard Erickson, wrote a book that was strongly influenced by labeling theory. And he entitled it, Making Crime. This book did not focus on trying to understand the nature of the criminal. That is, it did not try to understand why they had these rapacious natures. Why these rapacious natures hadn't been controlled? His book focused on the police organization. Erickson in his book asked why and how the police decided to pick on the people they do and to label them as criminals. Why they didn't pick others? Seem to have done very similar things. Like other work of this sort, Erickson explored how police exercised their discretion to label some people criminals while others escaped the label, even when they had done precisely the same thing. This, of course, in an ethnically complex society like Toronto, led Erickson to ask questions about such things as racial profiling and ethnic profiling. Have these in Australia all the time, in America all the time. How come our prisons don't reflect our population? Some people say they are more rapacious. Others may say it's all to do with our labeling system. You can imagine that this book totally enraged the police. What do you mean? We just make up everything out there? There are no crimes that we deal with. We make it all up. Are you crazy? And that was the end of the Central Criminology, working with the police in Canada for about 10 years or more. One of the things we see now, and the point I've been making, theory, stories, matter. They make a difference in our lives. They're not little ivory tower things. What these little squirrels up in this building do and other buildings here can make a difference in your life. Not all of them make a difference, but some of them do. Because they affect how we go on from one time-space moment to the next. Now, this cultural theory has opened up, as you can imagine, quite different policy directions and policy initiatives than control theory does. For example, programs have developed around slogans like decriminalization. Well, let's stop criminalizing people if the labels are making all the difference. Let's take marijuana off the list. Let's take everything off the list. The other idea was, why don't we engage in benign neglect? One of the problems if you label people and you say you're a criminal, other people start treating them as criminals. And then they can't get jobs. And then they really do become criminals. But they weren't in the first place. So perhaps we should have just left them alone. Especially if the crimes are minor. Perhaps we should have just left them alone. That's what we should be engaged in, is benign neglect. We shouldn't react too quickly. We shouldn't try and catch them when they're too young. They'll probably grow out of it. And another pathway that's come out of this that you might have heard of is called restorative justice. It draws a lot from labeling theory and culture theory. Let's not do blaming. My friend John Braithwaite, who's a key player in the criminal justice system, has something wonderful to say. He says, criminal justice system is the only system I know in the world when you blame someone, you think you solved the problem. He said, imagine if we ran the airline industry like that. When a plane crashed, he said, let's just find a person to blame them, and we'll send the plane up again just as it was. Imagine if we did that. So these things, that these sets of core ideas, all of them, can spin off in all kinds of interesting directions. And perhaps the lesson of labeling theory is, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words can also hurt me. And I could go on, because labeling theory gets us into discourse analysis and language and post-structuralism and structuralism and all sorts of interesting things that all take us away from the biological human in very interesting ways. And I don't think we should take these theories as saying, although I may say, the biological human is unimportant. What I think is important is the new avenues they open up, the new avenues for thinking. And I'm just going to stop here. I would have gone on to what I'm going to call strain theory and opened up some other pathways, new ways of thinking about power, new ways of going away from rules, new ways of thinking about the social. And I'm not going to take you on my personal anecdote, which is a shame. And I don't have time at the moment to let you look at my book either. So now I'm going to open it for questions, because I think I'm just about right on time. Stunned silence.
Please put back the book. Please put back the book.
The book. I'll put back the book briefly. The book's going to be called Where's the Chicken? And it's coming out of the people who publish that reverent series called Two Dog Press. And this is coming out under Mercury. And the idea behind the book comes out of an anecdote, out of work I was doing when I was running a program called the Community Peace Program, where someone burnt someone's house down, burnt down a shack. So you go to them and you say, why did you burn down their shack? Said, their son assaulted my son. Oh, you go to the son. Why did you assault his son? You know, every time we go past this house, they're swearing at us. Insults after insults after insults. We're sick of it. You go to them and say, why do you do that? It's their chickens. They shit all over the place. And it's driving us mad. And you say, why didn't you do something about the chicken? You can't call the police about chicken shit. Why didn't you do something about the inside? You can't call the police about insults. And what about the assault? Cost a half a bottle of brandy to get them to come for that. They burn a house down, they come immediately. So it's around that story that we begin to explore and try to explore what all of us, not just what our governments can do. It's one of the things that Nikki referred to as a lot of my work has been about all the things that other people do, other authorities do, beside governments, to govern our lives. The insurance companies, for example, that I'm looking at the moment, they're probably much more important in your life than the police. And they will control whether you get the police to do anything anyway. And there are all kinds of private authorities that I call private governments that impact on your lives.
Please read the small quote that Chicken is speaking.
It's really just a quote we put up for ourselves. We're expecting to get this quote from a person. It says, inspirational. Every South African needs to read this book. And I think that's absolutely true. Every South African. But anyway, I'm going to ask for a show of hands. If you have any preference for these various colors. Who's for one? Put your hand up.
I can't see the colors.
Who's for two?
Why don't we eliminate? Who's a gay? Is he a noble?
Right?